Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com, a special midweek Arsecast because, as is something of a tradition, after the transfer window closes, I try and catch up with the BBC's David Ornstein to get a bit of insight into what happens during the transfer windows, the business that Arsenal have done and not done. This particular transfer window, not the busiest. We've brought in Denis Suarez from Barcelona, but that's it. All in all, you would probably say, given the fight that we have for the top four and the fact we've lost three key players to injuries, a pretty underwhelming transfer window. There seem to be things going on, links with players like Yannick Carrasco and Ivan Perisic. And of course, in the background, there's all the stuff going on with Sven Mislintat. The head of recruitment is leaving the club after a little over a year, and that surely has had some kind of impact on what we did in January and probably what we're going to do in the summer as Raul Sanyehi becomes the man with all the power and all the responsibility. He is the head of football. He is going to appoint his own people, and we're going to see how they operate. The summer is going to be a very crucial summer, but of course Arsenal still have to continue the challenge for a top four and the Europa League as well. So I'll be chatting with David now. I was going to put this out first on Patreon for our Patreon subscribers, but I know how popular the David Ornstein podcasts are, so I'm making this free to everyone from the very start. But if you do feel like you want to support what we do on Arseblog and Arseblog News, and of course the podcasts every week, and you would like more content as well as supporting us, you can sign up for just a fiver a month plus VAT if you're in the EU. Go to patreon.com/arseblog. patreon.com/arseblog. You get instant access to all the extra content we have there and all the extra content we'll be producing in the future, as well as the warm glow of knowing that you're helping support everything that we do here on Arseblog, and we really do appreciate all our subscribers on Patreon. So thank you very much indeed. Now though, let's get on with it. This is me and David Ornstein. All right, as is now more or less tradition, after the end of every transfer window, I try and catch up with the BBC's David Ornstein to get a fuller picture of what's gone on at Arsenal, and I'm delighted to say that David is here with me now. Hi, David.
Hi, Andrew. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Let's start with the Arsenal window. For me, anyway, it was underwhelming. I felt Arsenal had defensive issues. We were linked with any number of attacking midfield players. In the end, we got in Denis Suarez from Barcelona on loan until the end of the season with no obligation to buy. Perhaps a signing that indicates the lack of firepower that Arsenal had at their disposal for whatever reason in this last transfer window.
Yeah, that's totally right, Andrew. And it's quite difficult to explain the full context of this because the truth is we really don't know it all. The budget, for instance, it was made very clear to me from a very early stage that it was meager, to say the least, that there was barely a budget. It was pretty much nothing. And I couldn't really believe it when I heard it, even though we know there was heavy investment in the previous two transfer windows. I was being told that they've got nothing to work with, a very, very small pot, and that will be for permanent signings, which therefore are incredibly unlikely, for loan signings and for the associated salaries and agents' fees on both fronts. So that's always going to be incredibly difficult to work with, especially in the January window when Arsenal have, and many other clubs have talked about it being a window where they'd prefer not to do business. Player values are overinflated. It's always a stopgap solution and a bit of an emergency. You can get good deals, as we've seen in the past, but it was not a deal that Arsenal were targeting when things had been looking good earlier.
Yeah.
And so the fact that they were sort of forced into action was far from ideal with such a small budget. So Denis Suarez was clearly a target for Unai Emery and Raul Sanlehi in particular. I don't think it was a signing that was universally supported across the Arsenal hierarchy and those who are influential on the recruitment side. But Raul Sanlehi is calling the shots now as the head of football. And of course, Unai Emery has a heavy influence and knew him from his time managing in Spain. And so that one was pretty clear and well documented. Many people said Arsenal need to go for a defender. That was never really mentioned to me. I did ask about it on a number of occasions to a number of people, and the only name who really cropped up on that front was Callum Chambers, and that Arsenal had vaguely explored the possibility of bringing him back from his loan deal at Fulham. However, that would have incurred a fee because he had played a certain number of games that would have triggered a recall fee. And so that was pretty quickly shelved, given that Arsenal's priority with this small amount of money was to perhaps bring in some reinforcements that could really help them.
Yeah.
In a more attacking sense, that was their priority, it seems.
Can I ask you just before we move on to other potential targets, because one of the things that Unai Emery said before the transfer window opened after the injury to Rob Holding was that we might look for a central defender who can help us, but he mentioned the fact that Dinos Mavropanos was coming back and he might be a player who could step up. What's the feeling inside about his quality and his readiness, particularly when Arsenal fans have looked at certain players and certain defenders in this team have chance after chance and underperform? It feels like maybe, particularly with the games coming up in the next few weeks, relatively, on paper at least, winnable fixtures, that it might be time to give him a run out and see what he can do. Because he was, let's remember, Sven Mislintat's first signing when he joined from Borussia Dortmund.
Yeah, he was extremely highly thought of, Mavropanos, and the idea coming into the season from a number of people I spoke to is that he would challenge for a starting berth at centre-half. I'm not sure anybody quite knew the extent of his injury. It's quite remarkable how long he's been out for. And at that point in time, you had Mavropanos coming into the picture. You had two defenders recruited in Sokratis, who had come off the back of a strong season and vastly experienced from club and international football, Dortmund and Greece, and then Lichtsteiner, who, despite ageing, was a free transfer and had vast club top level with Juventus and international experience with Switzerland. So I think Arsenal felt they were pretty well set at the back. Not perfect, but as we know from various proclamations, this was a work in progress over a number of years and transfer windows. So this was just the start. I've asked a little bit about Mavropanos, and it seems that there was some concern in terms of his calmness, whether he was a little bit nervous, a bit anxious when he came on the pitch, and prone to error, and some reservations. So I don't think that the level of regard so far is quite as universal as it might have looked when he was sort of emerging at the end of last season and into the summer. Indeed, of course, Arsene Wenger had kind of scoffed a little bit at his signing at the start, taken umbrage to the fact that it was a player he might not have known about. But then even he, I'm told, came round to the idea as early as the first training session, and the idea of sending him on loan was quickly shelved. So that will be really interesting. Somebody I spoke to feels that he should be thrown in now from the Huddersfield game onwards, Mavropanos, and that will be really interesting. There was no real talk of a defensive piece of recruitment, and I think that's mainly based on numbers rather than quality. Arsenal aren't stupid. They know there are defensive issues, but they also have a vast number of players, some of whom will be returning from injury. And so it was seen that a January signing would leave them with a difficult problem come the summer of having to shift a number of players. You could say that should be done and you've got to take those tough decisions, but they have got the numbers there. They do believe they have some quality, and perhaps this is one, I don't know, but perhaps this is one they're looking to sort out in the summer, a department that they'll be focusing on then.
Okay, well, I'm hopeful that some of this January inaction, particularly defensively, is because we do have summer targets, and we might talk about that in a more abstract way, because it's very difficult at this point. It's only February to start talking about the summer and what Arsenal are going to do and planning to do, particularly because there's been such upheaval behind the scenes with Mislintat, with Sanyehi, and we'll talk on that a bit in a moment as well. But just some of the other names that went around during the January transfer window. Yannick Carrasco was touted as a loan signing. Even Perisic emerged as a loan signing very late in the window, so we can only guess that perhaps it was a last minute attempt by Arsenal to bolster the squad in an area they thought they were going to need somebody in. And Christopher Nkunku from PSG, who I assume is a player that Unai Emery knows and recommended based on his knowledge of the player from his time with PSG.
Yeah, so I was told throughout the window that Arsenal were looking for a box-to-box midfielder and a wide player as their two priorities. And it was pretty clear from early on that one of the options, it's not clear exactly what position he'll be playing, was Denis Suarez. And then, and at that point, I didn't know about Carrasco, Perisic or Nkunku. They emerged as the window went on. Really starting with Perisic, who I think the Friday before, so with a week to go in the window, Arsenal made their approach to the representatives of Perisic and then subsequently Inter Milan. And although they were calm at this point about the possibility, outwardly calm anyway, to people like me, about the possibility of signing one player, two players or no players, my understanding is they went extremely hard for Perisic, and you don't get a player who hands in a transfer request and stops training and risks his relationship with a club the size of Inter Milan because he doesn't think he's coming. He definitely thought he would be coming to Arsenal and a deal would be done there.
That was, sorry to cut across, I mean, there was an interesting comment, wasn't there, from Spalletti, who said that basically Perisic had been conned by Arsenal. How much that says about the way we made the approach or how we tried to bring him in, I don't know. But it was an interesting comment all the same.
Yeah, I think Arsenal were in direct contact with Perisic and they were communicating that they would do everything to make the deal happen. However, one thing that was clear from Arsenal to all targets during the transfer window was that they could only be taken on loan with an option to buy and not an obligation. They told that to the very people they were targeting. And although they tried to be creative with Perisic, I know for a fact, by even offering a penalty fee, if the option to buy didn't become an obligation, in the case of Inter, they just were not interested in that. They wanted guaranteed money. Therefore, Arsenal reignited some interest that they started showing much earlier than Perisic, and that was Carrasco, because that was shown at the end of December, right at the beginning of January. It was proposed to the player. He was keen. I think he would have been happy to take a wage cut, although it would have still been a handsome salary. The problem was that the loan fee that Arsenal suggested at the beginning of the January window to his Chinese club was nowhere near a figure that they would have considered. In a loan market where fees are getting extraordinarily high these days, and Arsenal did end up offering a high fee for Perisic, the fee for Carrasco was really low. You could say perhaps understandably at the beginning of the window. They then went quiet as they both pursued other targets and had their own internal issues with the news that Mislintat would be leaving. And by the time it was looking like Perisic wouldn't happen, they reignited the conversations around Carrasco, but the offer, as I understand it, did not change. And so it was never likely to be considered by the Chinese club. And that was quite strange when they were offering so much I was told, for Perisic. So clearly Carrasco at that point also felt that Arsenal weren't particularly serious about him. In and amongst all of that was Nkunku, who was a target that unified the Arsenal hierarchy. They all wanted him. Again, on loan with an option to buy, he was seen as a high potential player who could perhaps succeed Aaron Ramsey as the box-to-box midfielder. And it wouldn't surprise me, I don't know for a fact, but it wouldn't surprise me if they reignite that interest in the summer. Whether a deal can be done then, I'm not sure. But that one was fascinating in its own right. Arsenal did think that that was doable because they were pursuing it right until the end of the transfer window. They really were. However, there were some other issues at play in the fact that PSG needed a midfielder. Was it the player from the MLS? And that deal didn't go through in the end, Acosta. With that in mind, Thomas Tuchel expressed a desire to keep Nkunku as part of his squad. And there were also suspicions, nothing I know factual, that there were politics at play in that, as we know, Tuchel and Mislintat's relationship from their time together at PSG ended in a very sour way, and was Tuchel determined not to do business and help out Mislintat before he signs off with Arsenal? Perhaps we'll never know, but that was the extent of, of Arsenal's January transfer window.
And is Unai Emery perhaps having more of an influence over potential targets, perhaps looking at his former club and some players who are at PSG? Nkunku, we believe, is a deal that might be reignited or worked on between now and the summer. But are there other people at that club he might be looking at?
Yeah, so I'm told that Unai Emery likes experienced players. He likes to go with players he knows and trusts. So that may explain, that certainly explains the Nkunku interest. He played him far more than Thomas Tuchel has played him in PSG this season. It explains the pursuit of Denis Suarez, who I know a number of people who have reservations about within the game, not just inside Arsenal. And then also the reported interest once again in Adrien Rabiot, who Arsenal were keen on during Arsene Wenger's time at the club, and his link to PSG in the French game. It seemed that he would be signing for Barcelona, but now they've signed Frenkie de Jong for that position from Ajax. And so there are credible reports that Arsenal will now try and come back in for Rabiot. There are people within Arsenal who are very keen that they sign Rabiot or try make a concerted effort. He's very highly admired. There are some complications around him and the people you have to deal with if you want to do a deal for him, and his salary demands. But I think that's certainly one that we should keep an eye on. Around certain players that have been suggested in the past, including Guendouzi, who I think Unai Emery was hugely on board with, I have heard that he would perhaps, whether it's favour or at least strongly consider alternatives who he knows well from the past and can trust. So when the Guendouzi signing was being discussed, I think Emery would have also liked as an alternative, if the Guendouzi one couldn't be done, or as a more immediate signing who he could trust for the here and now, he would have liked to have signed Steven Nzonzi, which I've subsequently heard. So that goes to indicate the point that you make. He likes players he can trust and that he's worked with at former clubs and who have experience to do the job now.
Okay, well, there are some names there that might get people a bit excited. Obviously, it depends on what Arsenal do between now and the end of the season and the race for the top four and a Champions League spot via the Europa League, perhaps, which will obviously inform the summer business. But we might just touch on that in the longer term in a moment. How much, David, do you think what's gone on with Sven Mislintat has had an impact on what Arsenal did in January? Because although the story emerged during the month of January, I think, or somewhere around the start of the month, it's been rumoured for a little while that things haven't been quite as coherent in the background as we would like them to be. So when Unai Emery was appointed and Arsene Wenger was replaced, this trident was put in place to run the football club, which was Ivan Gazidis as the chief executive, Raul Sanyehi, head of football, Sven Mislintat, the head of recruitment, and these three guys were supposed to work in synchronicity and work really well together. But as ever, when there's a sort of a power vacuum at a club, things don't always go the way you would like them to go, and people aren't always on the same page. Ivan Gazidis left to go to AC Milan. I'd be curious briefly as to your thoughts on how quickly he decided to leave, having overseen this change, and whether you think he had some responsibility to manage it in the shorter term. But Mislintat is going, and it feels like there is a bit of a problem because he has identified good talent for Arsenal. He has brought in good players, and it feels like a little bit of a step backwards when a very highly regarded head of recruitment is leaving after just over a year. So that situation in general and the impact it might have had on what Arsenal did in January.
Yeah, it's not been an ideal time for Arsenal behind the scenes. Although it hasn't quite looked so ugly to the public, I think it has been quite messy in the background. Let's be fair to the club. When the new structure was brought in by Ivan Gazidis, none of them had really worked together before. And it was a shock to the system of everybody at the club that Gazidis was then walking away from that new structure. I think his feeling was that he had done what he was there to do. He'd been there for a decade. He'd brought this new structure in place. And if he was to stay on for a year, which he could have done, or longer, he would have been doing so, relatively speaking, with his feet up and collecting his salary and not particularly influencing things, because the people he had brought into the club would be doing that. Others will take real exception to that idea, and they will think that it was his duty to smooth over the transition period, lead it forward before considering moving away. I've seen some compare him to David Cameron in that sense, a little bit harsh, I think we'd all agree. So none of these guys knew each other. Suddenly Raul Sanlehi is promoted to head of football, and I think it's quite understandable that he would potentially want his own person in. I don't think that's exceptional in any walk of life for a person who is going to be running the show. But I think from the moment that Vinay Venkatesham and Raul Sanlehi were promoted and Sven Mislintat was not, the writing was on the wall. So that was around September time when the Gazidis announcement came. We know this, that Mislintat was wanting to become the technical director at Arsenal, which is a position we believe they're looking to create. And
it was one he was promised, I believe, when this trident was put in place. It was from the Gazeta side of things that he was appointed on the basis of the fact that he would become the technical director. And actually, towards the end of last year, there were stories in certain newspapers which said he was being appointed as the technical director, but that was never officially confirmed.
Well, I don't know if he was promised it, and I don't doubt your information on that. I just don't know it personally. What I do know is that he expressed very clearly his desire to take that role because he felt that he was already assuming many of the roles of a technical director, and he had expressed to Gazidis that he would have liked that position. He, therefore, would have seen it as a huge blow that my understanding is that there was no recommendation as Gazidis left for Mislintat to take that position, by which point I think, so we're talking September, October time, that the writing was already well on the wall for Mislintat by that point. One person I spoke to in the game felt that if Arsenal appointed a Spaniard as their head coach, even though Mislintat was closely involved, he was on what was called a three-man panel of Mislintat, Gazidis and Sanlehi, but was really four because it included Jason Rosenvelt, who is extremely influential at the club. Even though Mislintat had that position, there was some in the game who felt if Arsenal appointed a Spaniard, that it would be the beginning of the end for Mislintat, because you would start to see a sort of a Spanish nucleus build, and that might not include him. And some may say that's understandable. And interestingly, you know, Mislintat was one of those who was in favour of Emery's appointment. So it appeared he was thinking in Arsenal's best interest there. And of course, the other, the number two candidate was Mikel Arteta. So either way, it looks like there would have been a Spaniard coming in. So as we approached winter, things were getting pretty messy because Mislintat likes to plan for transfer windows long in advance. He's done it his whole career, really immersing himself in the players that his clubs are targeting, and doing his due diligence and earning the trust of many of these boys who are young, which has been his sort of forte over the years. I was told one story from years gone by that he immersed himself so much in the player's culture and environment that he went into the community and prayed with the player and his family, which was one of the more sort of bizarre stories I've heard. But it shows the length he goes to. And a year into his position at Arsenal, which was sort of late November, early December, he sought assurances that from Sanlehi, I presume, that he was part of the future, so he could continue planning for January and start planning for the summer. And I think he would have also spoken to Josh Kroenke on that front, and those assurances didn't come. So terrible timing, really, because Arsenal needed to do some business in the transfer window. Mislintat, I think, was the guy who sort of led the Carrasco approach at the start, and also the Perisic approach, given that he brought him in or worked with him, knows him from Dortmund. And then Sanlehi took over many of these negotiations, such as the Perisic deal. And that's no way to run a successful transfer window.
Yeah.
Although they came out of it in I guess you could say, reasonable shape, because they dodged a bit of a bullet on the money they would have been committing to what would have then been the 30-year-old in Perisic. The jury was out from many I speak to on Carrasco. And Denis Suarez, we'll make our own minds up on him in time.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see what kind of an impact he can have. And I'm curious, really, to see what he can do and really what Unai Emery expects of a player who's barely played any football this season and is being dropped into a new club, a new country. No, it's not a new. I know he was at Manchester City, but it's still new for him in terms of the football he's played, the Premier League. He never played for City outside the League Cup. Fingers crossed he can come in and make a bit of an impact. It does mean, though, that Arsenal, the planning and I suppose the long-term strategizing that we all hoped would go into the recruitment policy is now going to take a different direction under Raul Sanlehi. He is the head of football. He's obviously going to appoint a new head of scouting. I don't know if you've heard anything about who exactly is going to be the man there. We've heard of Francis Cagigao. I don't quite know how to pronounce his surname, but he's been a long-time scout in Spain, so there's a Spanish connection there, and he's brought us players like Cesc Fabregas, Hector Bellerin, and was instrumental in transfers like Alexis Sanchez and Santi Cazorla, Nacho Monreal as well. He could be that. So there's a lot now riding on Sanlehi, and that too might have informed what we did in January, that if he is the man now on whom the responsibility rests and to whom the finger can be pointed based on the decisions that he makes, he probably didn't want to do any stopgap business in January anyway and is looking to the summer to make sure that the signings we make are the right signings.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it. I mean, if we go back a step, I think from few people I've spoken to, Mislintat's plan was to kind of step back and assess what he was inheriting in his first year in charge. So he wanted to let the scouting operation function as it was, so he could make some decisions, and then after a year in the job, he would start to restructure it and exert his influence. And I think by the sounds of it, he was trying to start to do that at a point at which it was already too late. And there was some unrest behind the scenes within the scouting department at his sort of hands-off approach. And I think probably by his own admission, he would do things slightly differently if he had his time again. I'm not sure how good his relationship was with Kajau, or however you made a far better fist of pronouncing it than me. And those I speak to have a feeling that Kajau will be promoted to the sort of head of recruitment role, or call it what you like, chief scout. He's been there for a long time, and I think he's got a good working relationship with Raus and Lehi. We'll wait to see on that one. A number of names have been mentioned for the technical director role, and two of the criteria, I was told, was that either the person must be known and trusted by Emery or have a really strong connection with Arsenal. And somebody that doesn't tick one of those boxes is not going to be an ideal candidate. Of course, there are many more factors. I'm speaking broadly. And so that's why you saw the likes of Edu mentioned. I think Edu will end up staying in Brazil, where his family are based, even though it's in a different city there in Sao Paulo. He's in Rio. There, I think he's pretty settled there with the national team. Even though a few years ago I was told that because of the distance between the two cities, he was keen on a new project that would reunite him in the same place, and there were people inside Arsenal under Wenger during the Wenger reign who would have liked him to come in then, but I don't think it will happen with Edu now. Mark Overmars linked for the same reasons, the Arsenal connection. Whereas on the flip side, somebody who has the connection to Emery but not Arsenal is Monchi. I don't know this for a fact, but I have been told by a few people that he is San Lehi's first choice and Emery's first choice as well. There's obviously the connection from Sevilla. Things aren't going particularly well at Roma, but he's extremely highly regarded within the game. And one person even told me that that's a done deal, but I don't know that for a fact, and it's not strong enough information for me to be able to report it outright. But I think that could be one that develops in the coming weeks, as Arsenal really need to get moving for the summer transfer window, because other clubs are already, you know, holding their negotiations and doing their groundwork now.
Yeah,
it's difficult for Arsenal because they don't know what money they're going to be playing with. There are some suggestions around the £40 million mark, depending on what competition Arsenal get in. I've been told that it could be around £100 million to spend. As we know with Arsenal, that would factor in salaries as well. And we need to see what competition they get in. And there needs to be intelligent recruitment as well. It's all well and good having the 100 million or however many hundred millions or less. But how intelligently they do it is going to be the key factor here, because it's not going to be the level of money that many other clubs will have.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow.
Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/arsblog.
What's your sense of how Raul Senyehi views or understands the job that he's got now at Arsenal? Because at Barcelona, where he was director of football for many years, he's at a gigantic institution with, I won't say endless money, but with a lot more money than Arsenal, and with more ability to soak up bad transfers and poor deals. And there were many of those at Barcelona over the years. You can think of dozens, maybe not dozens, but handfuls of players that they've signed for big money who didn't really work out or weren't worth what they paid. In fact, a number of those players came from Arsenal to Barcelona under Sanyehi's watch. Whereas at Arsenal, you know, the hope I think we had, if we all understand that financially we're not going to be on the same level as some of the other clubs in the Premier League, the idea that we were going to do business better and smarter was the way to create a competitive advantage, or at least keep up with these clubs. Sanyehi can't operate at Arsenal the way that he did at Barcelona. Could that explain the links with Monchi, who in his job as director of football at Sevilla, or whatever exactly title he had at Sevilla, was responsible for bringing in players for very low fees and selling them for very high fees? Is that part of why he might be brought in? Not just the connection with Emery, but this sort of recyclable transfer system that we kind of have to get on, where we bring in younger players, develop them, and if they stay, great, and if we sell them for a big profit, then also not great, but we can reinvest that money back into the team. And that's how Arsenal are going to fund themselves via this KSE self-sustaining model.
Yep, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. It's all going to be about intelligent recruitment. And Sanyehi's a really intelligent guy. He's very impressive. He's very experienced. But it will be really interesting to see the sort of players that Arsenal bring in, and whether that hints at his relationship-based approach, whether we see some signings that we can trace back to a certain or a number of agents. And I know that Sanyehi moves in some different circles to some people. You know, Arsenal were very reluctant to do business in the past with the likes of Jorge Mendes, Mino Raiola, and Kia Jurabchian. I think Sanyehi has decent relationships with people like this. And so we could see that becoming an interesting facet of Arsenal's recruitment. I'm really keen to see the background of the players they bring in the coming transfer windows. Monchi, for example, brought in Justin Kluivert, didn't he, to Roma. That's a Mino Raiola player. So that's going to be a really interesting dynamic, because we know that Sanlehi's approach has been more relationship-based than sort of analytics and real long-term groundwork like somebody like Mislintat favoured. And I think that was part of the reason why there was a difference in philosophies between those two. And they didn't do things the same way. And I don't think there was a particularly acrimonious fallout or anything. I just don't think they were ideally suited for each other, Mislintat and Sanyehi. So, that will be interesting. The self-sustaining model, we're told, is here to stay. And the money, as you say, is not going to be sufficient to compete with some of the biggest clubs. I am told that the Arsenal are extremely well set up now from a sort of analytics and data point of view, with Stats DNA, and Jason Rosenfeld is extremely highly talked about, and Hus Farmi is really influential. He's not just the contracts man, he has day-to-day contact with the players. He's said to be a shining light at Arsenal that they're very fortunate to have. He gets involved in day-to-day meetings with the sort of the the real power brokers within the club. And I'm told that on the coaching side, Freddie Ljungberg has impressed. Some would like to see him integrated into the first team somewhat. Per Mertesacker as well, despite the controversy about Per Mertesacker going to an NBA game when his under-23s were playing in the North London Derby. I've told that people inside the club felt that was a bit of a nonsense. He's doing really good work and it is highly regarded. Unai Emery's coaching sessions are said to be very intense. His number two is a really highly regarded coach by many I speak to within the game. So I think things are set up pretty well for Arsenal, but everything will now come down to Sanlehi and how he can drive the football club forward, because he has complete authority, I'm told. Obviously, Vinay Venkatesham running the commercial and business side, he supports Sanlehi in all of his decisions on the football side, and Sanlehi supports Venkatesham in all of his decisions on the commercial and business side. And I think the Cronkies leave these guys to it. So yeah, it's going to be an incredibly fascinating period in Arsenal's history. And you've already seen, their willingness to go in for players that they know, in terms of Denis Suarez, who, as I said, I'm not sure people within the game feel is the right signing for Arsenal in this January transfer window, and the type of player, character, personality to spearhead a drive for the top four. But I think connections will be key in Arsenal's recruitment now, and let's watch this space.
Okay, just a couple of things before I let you go. The self-sustaining model, the way that the Cronkies and KSE are running the club is not a surprise to anybody. They have 100% control right now. But as a fan, it's very difficult to hear them talk about the ambitions that they have for the club, at the same time looking at what they're doing. You know, the interview over the weekend ahead of the Super Bowl where Josh Kroenke's talking about getting back into or getting to the Champions League final, it seems very detached from the reality of where Arsenal are right now. We're in a fight to get back into the top four. The Champions League final at this point is something of a pipe dream. So in terms of how they're setting the tone or setting the ambition of the club, is it in any way founded in reality, or are these simply sound bites which have very little substance to them when you look at what the reality of Arsenal's situation is compared to what they say they want for the club? Because it's hard to marry the two things. It's hard to marry Premier League success and Champions League success without the owners providing some kind of a push to make that happen. Or do they feel they can generate this organically through this new structure and this new setup with more time?
Well, I think the double-edged sword from an ownership perspective is that the Cronkies are quite hands-off, and that means that they allow the people who are running the club on a day-to-day basis autonomy to make decisions and to drive things forward. Mm. And many people would say that's a good thing, but on the flip side, they are ultimately holding the purse strings and making the final decisions. And so that presents a pretty problematic dilemma at times, especially in terms of what budgets are available and what those on the ground have got to work with. And I'm taking nothing away from those who, like Jeremy Wilson, a brilliant journalist who's managed to build a relationship there and speak to those guys. But also, we don't often hear from them on some of the subjects that the supporters and the public really want to hear from them on, such as the direction for the club. I don't see a really clear vision on where Arsenal are going. And if they have it, we're probably not hearing it articulated well enough or precisely enough, because as you say, it appears a bit fanciful and not in touch with reality. And I don't know if those on the ground are fully aware of what that plan and project is, and whether it's being carried out to the Americans' satisfaction. Mm. Certainly, those I speak to suggest that I spend a lot of time inside other clubs as well as spending time around Arsenal, and you see the culture, you feel it. And I don't want this to come across as a sort of cheap generalisation. It's just what I felt, but it's also what people inside these clubs have told me and inside Arsenal. Some of these clubs, you really sense and smell and feel a winning culture, an absolute unequivocal demand to win. Within Arsenal, various people who have worked there over the years have described London Colney as being like an oasis, like a spa, almost like a holiday camp. It's a lovely environment. It's fantastic for players and staff. But is it somewhere that is conducive to, you know, ruthlessly driven to succeed? And surely that stems from the very top. We've seen with Abramovich at Chelsea over the years and the Abu Dhabi group at Manchester City, just two examples. One interesting point, a couple of people I spoke to at City were surprised that at the weekend's match, of course, directors can't do anything on the pitch, but the Arsenal decision makers were all at the Super Bowl when many people will be surprised to hear that they weren't at the Etihad Stadium.
Wow.
Now, we don't know the sort of political influence behind it, whether they were expected by the American owners to be over at the Super Bowl, their association with the Rams, etc. But that surprises me a little bit.
Yeah.
That they were over there on the day of a big match and they weren't in the director's box at the Etihad Stadium. Where are the priorities? Now, that clearly is just a one-off, and I think Arsenal are being fairly well led in terms of Sandehi and Venkatesham. They both strike me as being impressive individuals, and if they get this technical director role right, allied to those I've also mentioned in other roles at the club, I think they're in pretty good shape. I don't think they're far off, but
it's just that push, isn't it? That extra desire to really achieve things. You know, for a while it's felt like Arsenal have been going through the motions, and maybe we're a little bit harsh because it's still only, 9 months since Arsene Wenger was announced as leaving the club, and this is clearly a new era and a new structure. But it's long felt to me like that burning ambition, which you can get from the very top of the club, which pushes everybody, not just the manager or the players, but everybody within the club, isn't there with the Cronkies because they are so far away and because of the way they operate. They delegate, they put people in place to do this, but it feels like they put people in place to do just a good enough job rather than the best possible job, and they don't really give them the backing financially in order to make that happen.
Yeah, that would appear to be the case. And it's a stark reality that Arsenal, the only Premier League club whose owners have not put a penny in of their own money. But I've got to be quite careful on this because I don't know the exact financial situation. And the likes of Kieran from Swiss Ramble are far more articulate and informed than me. But I don't know the exact situation around financial fair play and whether Arsenal, by taking owner investment, would be getting into dangerous territory around their compliance with FFP and also the Premier League wage increase restrictions. So I'm going to sort of pass judgment on that one. And it's not fair for me to give the benefit of the doubt to the Cronkies one way or the other.
Yeah.
We've seen them invest personal money in America. So it really is a fascinating area. But Arsenal, when you speak to them, are very calm. They see this as a project, which is strange that we all seemed okay with it at the start. It's going to be a few years. I was told that 2019-20, the start of that season, was when Arsenal were hoping to be competitive again. I was told that a year ago it would take 3, 4, 5 transfer windows. They were very realistic. Emery was a long-term appointment. And perhaps that 22-match unbeaten run was a bit of a curse to him, because it seems that many expectations have changed and suddenly people are questioning his suitability for the position. Of course, he's not immune to questions on the pitch and tactical decisions. That there are some things that clearly haven't been done right as he's trying to explore and find his team balance, etc., etc. There's far more better qualified people to speak on that than me. But I think people need to relax a little bit and see how this plays out, rather than jumping to sort of conclusions in the immediate term. I'm not a sympathiser of the Kroenkes. I know many people that have a very dim view of them inside and outside Arsenal and within the game. The proof is going to be in the pudding over the next year or two. And I'm not trying to duck an answer. For instance, why was there no money to spend in the January transfer window? Well, we know Arsenal spent heavily in the previous two transfer windows. We know they have revenue streams coming on in terms of Adidas in the summer. There's been various talk around stadium refinancing, possible covenants, stuff that I'm not particularly au fait with. But the truth is, we don't know exactly why there was no money to spend. It hasn't been communicated properly, either publicly or in private. We don't know the precise sums. I've been told it could be £100 million in the summer. We've been told that in the past, and we don't want to either excite or disappoint people. This is a real time of flux for Arsenal. It seems a shame, a real shame, that just when it appeared that Arsenal were building in the right direction over the last year, that they managed to have encountered problems behind the scenes with the Mislintat situation, with the contractual problems around Mesut Ozil, Aaron Ramsey. They've got to shift some players out of the club in the summer. I think they will do so. I think Sanlehi is quite a ruthless operator. But it is a shame that that aim of being competitive from the start of the 2019-20 season seems like it suddenly has been derailed somewhat. That said, I think that Emery is an appointment who the club are fully behind and will work together with him to get things right. One concerning point I was told internally is that the one of the issues under Arsene Wenger was that he wasn't challenged enough by others around the club. He'd built such a power base that his authority and his decisions were never really challenged. I'm actually hearing similar things around Emery, that Sanlehi is a huge supporter of his. He doesn't want to impinge on his areas of authority. And some feel that Emery should already be being challenged more in the way that he challenges many of his players, a healthy environment.
Yeah.
And that's if that's a cultural problem within Arsenal, then that firstly may come from on high and the culture needs to shift. And in any cultural shift, as we know, anywhere in the world, it does take time and it's not what people are going to want to hear. But I think Arsenal is a project that is not close to coming to fruition yet. And if it does, and if things come together in the way they could, then I think it's going to be pretty exciting. But people are going to have to sort of use that word they really hate and have patience.
Just very finally, David, I just want to ask you about a story that emerged during the transfer window. You spoke on BBC Five Live. The situation with Mesut Ozil and Unai Emery, or Mesut Ozil and Arsenal as a whole, is a really curious one. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like it. The suggestion to Ozil that it might be best for him to leave the club was the story that you came out with on Sunday at the Etihad. When Arsenal were 3-1 down and trying to get back into the game, Unai Emery left Ozil on the bench and put on Suarez, a player who is clearly not quite match fit yet because of how little he's played this season. He didn't really know his teammates. He's only been at the club 3 days, and he's putting him on ahead of a guy who, for all his issues, and there are valid criticisms of Mesut Ozil, does have the quality and vision and talent to change a game. And, you know, we can use the caveat away from home against one of the big sides is not necessarily when he shines. But even leaving that aside, it felt a bit, to me anyway, like Emery hammering another nail into the Ozil-shaped coffin that he's been handcrafting all season long. So can you give us any insight into what exactly is happening there, or what the likely outcome might be?
Well, immediately after Ozil signed his new contract, or let's take it back even further. In the build-up to that, there were people inside the club who didn't want him to be given that contract.
Could I just ask, did they want him to be given a contract but not that contract? Is there a distinction there?
I think there are some within the club who do not feel that he is producing what is required of him and would prefer him to have not been given a contract at all. And there are some who felt that if you're going to give him that new contract, a new contract, then it should be for nowhere near the money that Arsenal ended up agreeing to, by which point Ozil had a strong hand in the negotiations because Alexis Sanchez was on his way out of the club. And it would have been a pretty tough time for Arsenal if they were going to be losing both of them within the space of a few months. There was very little interest in clubs buying him at that point, but losing him on a free would have been potentially embarrassing for Arsenal. So there were some who were disgruntled with the decision to award him a contract, that contract, take it whichever way you like. They were hoping that by handing him the captain's armband as part of a group of captains, handing him the number 10 shirt and putting an arm around him after what happened with Germany at the World Cup, that they were going to have a really productive season out of him. But clearly there have been troubles settling in to the new way of playing under Unai Emery. I think you saw the way he left the pitch during the game at Chelsea in the second game of the season, that he didn't look particularly happy. And then we know, I think, ahead of the Bournemouth game, that Unai Emery had made it clear that he didn't see Ozil being of value in big away games. I've been told that Emery has, at the point at which I said it on Five Live around that period of quite a few weeks ago now, had expressed to Ozil that it might be better for him to leave. What we don't know, which you guys have pointed out in one of the Askcasts previously, whether that was the feeling of Emery, whether it was the feeling of the hierarchy, or whether it was the feeling of both of them. I suspect it was probably the feeling of both of them. However, if one party felt it more than the other, I would suspect it was the hierarchy. Not using Emery as their puppet, but expressing their feelings through him, because it's understood that Emery was quite keen to possibly take Ozil when he was PSG coach, and that some vague discussions took place about whether Ozil as a free agent last summer, and if Emery had stayed on, could have joined PSG, and Emery could have built a team around him as the number 10. So I'd be surprised. Emery, the sort of coach who really seems to take pleasure from bringing the best out of players, wasn't up for the fight. I think it was more a financially motivated thing that had come from on high, that this guy's earning £350,000 a week and he's not producing the level of consistency that we would like. If he was, I don't think this would be a particular issue. And Ozil's view was that I'm not leaving, certainly not in the January transfer window. And obviously everybody will see what happens in the summer. I've been told that he's training well, that he's not a problem within the camp. But the way he's being used or not used, I don't know this for a fact, but it would appear that possibly Emery is not playing him for the very reason of encouraging Ozil to seek pastures new in the summer.
So to sort of make life so uncomfortable for him that if he wants to play football on a regular basis, he has to consider leaving. And in order to do that, he might have to agree to terms that are perhaps less favourable to him than he's on at Arsenal right now, thus saving Arsenal lots of money.
Yeah, we're not privy to the technical decisions here. And you can understand why Denis Suarez was brought on at Manchester City, because he needs to play. He's potentially only with the club until the end of the season, and he needs minutes under his belt. Ramsey coming on ahead of Ozil. Well, Ramsey's been playing better than Ozil, but he's leaving at the end of the season. A number of the games in which Ozil's not figured. I don't know this for a fact. It's just one possible theory that he's not being played so that he has no choice in the summer if he wants to resume his career. That then he has to move, and it gets this £350,000 a week problem off of Arsenal's hands. Now, there is also a theory that if he plays, he could play well, and then the fans demand that he stays, and he gives Arsenal a headache in that sense if they've already made their decision on him. But also, him not playing potentially reduces his value too. So it's a really confusing situation. There's no clarity around it at all. And it's deeply dissatisfactory for Arsenal and for Ozil, and surely can't go on.
Mm. Well, look, we'll see how it plays out between now and the end of this particular season. It feels to me like if Arsenal really do want to get back in the top four, finding some way of getting something out of Mesut Ozil between now and then is going to be absolutely key to that. David, as ever, it's been an absolute pleasure. We'll hopefully talk again towards the summer, perhaps, when we might have a clearer idea of who is going to be making the decisions, who the technical director might be, and which players we might be targeting in the transfer window. But as ever, thanks very much indeed, and I'm glad to have you on.
Anytime, Andrew. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed to David Ornstein. You don't need me to tell you to go and follow him on Twitter, because you're all doing it already, aren't you? If not, BBCSport_David, BBCSport_David. A lot went on at Arsenal in January, and I think if you listen between the lines a bit, things have not been as well run or as coherent as we would have liked, hence possibly some of the inaction that we saw during the month. And whether that impacts Unai Emery and his ability to get the team into the top four, we won't be able to tell in the very short term, but between now and May we'll certainly have a very good idea as to how that has had an effect on our season. Hopefully when we next talk to David, probably sometime towards the summer, we might have a better idea of what the club is going to do and what it can do in the transfer market, because we'll have an idea of what kind of European football we're playing. Fingers crossed it's the Champions League, because I think that will have a very positive effect on the recruitment that we do. It makes it easier to get better players in, simple as that, if you're in the Champions League. So fingers crossed for that. Hope you enjoyed this bonus midweek extra special Arsecast with David. Remember, do give us a rating or a review on iTunes. That would be greatly appreciated. And as I mentioned at the start, if you feel like signing up to become an Arseblog member on Patreon, that would be absolutely great as well. Patreon.com/Arseblog. Until Friday, when we're looking ahead to the game against Huddersfield. Take it easy. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.